Oh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's edition, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depths of the most terrifying imaginations with two audio adaptations of frightening fiction about streaming scenarios and frightening fraternities. I'm your host, Otis Gyrie, and tonight, I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. I also wanted to take a moment to thank you for all your donations. We are getting closer, but still need your help. Every bit. Every share, donation, and comment of support helps. So let's keep building this together. Joining us tonight to help us bring to life the frightening fiction of Kisto Healy and Scott Savino is Melissa Medino, Danielle Hewitt, Eric Peabody, Jeff Sturdivant, and Nick Goroff. Now, get your tickets ready. Take your seat in our Theater of the Minds and brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first tale this evening is written by Kisto Healy and performed by Melissa Medina, Danielle Hewitt, and Eric Peabody. In it, a social media influencer receives a box to inbox live on her stream. The box ends up being filled with smaller boxes. What's in them? Nothing. What will be in them? Let's find out. Now, without further ado, I present to you the box.
I'm feeling nervous because I've never done anything like this before, and it's honestly pretty creepy. I don't know how much is rumors and how much is truth, but I guess I'm about to find out. I look over at Max. Max is my partner in crime. We've been shipped 1,000 times, but remain just friends, at least as far as our videos and streams go. In truth, I've banged my cameraman more than a few times. We're best friends, and we live together. I mean, it's bound to happen, right? Max has a girlfriend, though, and we vibe weird as it is. So, is this legit? I ask him.
That's what you wanted, right?
I mean, ish.
Ish?
Like, if I thought it was real and my followers thought it was real, it would be okay if it wasn't real. You know? You could have anything you wanted in there and sealed it. Made it look good. Max frowns.
And you could have told me that before I went down some pretty creepy roads to get this thing for you.
Yeah, I know, but like, I didn't think you would do that.
Why not? I do every damn thing you ask of me. That's why Macy hates you.
I mean, I knew you would get something. I just didn't think it would be the genuine article, you know? Like, we've done several cursed objects videos. I mean, you're gonna tell me that the dolls and stuff you gave me were actually cursed. Max shrugs. The dude actually shrugged. How sus is that? Unbelievable. Let's just start, I say with a roll of my eyes. I watch him turn the camera on and I flip my hair and smile. Hey, my beauties, Lizzie Gordon here, not to be confused with Lizzie Borden, unfortunately. I laugh. Okay, today is the big day, Lizzie X. We are going to do something we have never done before, and we're going to do it live. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button because you're going to want to see what's next after this one. For the Lizzie X that have already ridden the horror train with us, you know, and have probably been excited waiting for the unboxing stream. But for those of you that are stopping in for the first time, my bestie Max, say hi, Max. Max turns the camera around to view his handsome face. Makes me think of things we've done, but now is not the time. Especially because I know Macy is watching. Macy is always watching. Max gives a friendly wave and says,
"Hi."
Before turning the camera back to me, Max went and got us a blind box from the dark web. This is a thing you can actually do. I've seen some other videos and heard horror stories, but it was all pre-recorded videos on social media, and frankly, I didn't know whether to believe them or not. And what do you think? If you've seen dark web box videos, comment below on whether or not you believe they're real. We love to hear your opinions and stories. We're a community here at Lizzie's Horror Funhouse. All of you matter just as much as Max does. Not as much as me, but definitely as much as Max. I'm laughing when Max yells,
"Hey!"
We always throw stuff like that in so we feel real. It makes people laugh and feel connected. We did tons of research on what works, and that's why I've gone viral and reached diamond status. I'm just kidding. Everyone knows how much the Lizziags love Max. I mean, who else is going to navigate the horrifying pathways of the dark web to get this for us, right? I wave my arm and Max pans the camera over to the giant box on our table. It's very clearly still taped. The camera comes back to me and my smile widens. We've done lots of unboxings on this stream. Cursed objects, banned toys, scariest dolls, and so much more. But I promise you, we have not done anything like this. You and I are in the same boat, friends. I have no idea what's in that box. Max insists it's a genuine article, and we have no reason to doubt our boy Max. Remember the time I asked him to find an actual possession and he got that doll from Italy? And that was by far the creepiest thing I've ever encountered, but who knows what's in the box, Lizzie X? We may find something much creepier. But then again, maybe it will be nothing. The only way we're gonna find out is by opening the box. I'm not gonna lie to y'all, I'm a little scared. Like, it could be anything. Right? I've read about boxes full of needles or tampons, bloody clothes that may or may not have been linked to a crime, actually illegal drugs, someone's placenta. I mean, the dark web is a scary place. There are some crazy people out there, and not the fun kind of crazy like us here at the Funhouse, Lizzie X. I'm talking about true-to-life murder maniac crazy. So, let's dig in and find out what we just bought from the scariest place in the world. If you haven't already, please remember to like and subscribe. Max, let's take the camera over to the box. I want them to see whatever's in it at the same time we do. We're all in this together, Lizzie X. I follow Max as he walks slowly towards the box. I stand where he can film me and the box at the same time. People want to see the box, but they also want to see me. If they didn't, my friend-zoned account wouldn't have so many views. I don't even do nudes, lewds only. But it's enough to keep them coming back. Max and I bought this house just to film in and use for our videos. Can you imagine? My parents have been paying on their house since before I was born, and I just bought this one with fan money. We have another that we actually live in and play in. This one is just for our channel and videos. I'm 24, and I've got 2 houses and 4 cars. Hopefully, whatever's in that box will widen my audience and increase my revenue even more. I'm excited as I am frightened. Okay, look how big this box is. Max, zoom in. Look at this. I point. There are wet marks. Did that happen during travel? There's no return address. Who knows where it came from, or how far it had to travel to get here. Or is there something in this box that is making the wet marks on the cardboard? Go ahead and jump on into that comment section again, Lizzie X. Let Max and I know what you think is in the box. If we open the box and any of your comments are actually in the box, we will give you $500. You know, we always like to give what we can to support the people supporting us. So go ahead and get those comments in. I check the feed and the passing comments. They go by fast, so I try to catch some good ones. They're mostly hearts and professions of love for both myself and Max, as per usual. Marty69 says used underwear will be in the box. I hope not. Cleo is real says a dead baby. Really, Cleo? I don't even think the dark web is that dark. I'll take the underwear after all, I guess. Get some help, girl. No, I'm just playing. Who knows? Maybe Cleo is right. I'll give it another minute to get your guesses in, and then we're gonna go ahead and cut the tape on this sucker. In the meantime, I'm gonna keep trying to solve this horror cube. A fan gave it to me, and I cannot figure it out. I know there's a trick to it. I stand to the side of the scene and twist and turn the cube. I figured the cube out ages ago. Nothing crazy happened. It's literally just a gimmicky puzzle, but things like this add tension and excitement to the videos. Max, what do you think happens when I solve the cube?
Maybe it's like Hellraiser,
he says with a laugh. I hope so. Pinhead is hot. Lizzie X, like and comment if you would get with Pinhead. Oh, and which incarnation? Let us know. I put the cube down and check the feed. All right, we've had a bunch of guesses on what will be in our dark web reveal in a moment. Some of them I'm not gonna say, but some are really interesting. Horrorfan XYZ72 says a live snake. I'm not gonna lie, I think that would be fire. I've always wanted a snake. Another Lizziak said scorpions. Someone said Vegemite. Oh, that might be the scariest of all. Max made me eat that on one of our prank shows. I was sick all day.
You put stink powder in my shampoo,
he says from behind the camera.
I couldn't get the smell out. My head smelled like a fart for days.
I laugh louder than the joke warrants. Like and subscribe if you'd like to see Max and I do another prank episode. Comment dares you'd like to see, but guys, please leave the sexual ones out. We're not ever going to do that stuff. I'm sorry. I laugh again. All right, I'd say it's time. You ready to do this? I take a deep breath. Max cues some ominous music and focuses on the box. I lift my cool knife and show it to the camera. This came from a fan. It's not even a replica. I looked into it, and this baby is authentic. Someone sent me the actual knife used in Barbershop Massacre 3 cut and style. I love it. I don't really ever use it. I keep it on display, but I feel like this is a special occasion, so I broke this baby out. The barber is going to show us what's in our dark web blind box. If you haven't seen the movie, go give it a watch. It's a hoot. Some creative kills led by the blade right here. Horror fan's dream. I wiggle it in front of the camera and flash a smile for the fans. Then Max leans in to film my hand as I push the knife into the tape and slide it along until it pops and the flaps open a little. I look at the camera, shake off a less than imaginary chill, and build tension. Then I popped the tape on the edges and took a deep breath. All right, folks. The moment of truth. Are we ready to see what the dark web sent us? Before I open these flaps and reach into this ultra-creepy, suspiciously wet box, please take a moment to join the Lizzie X Funhouse Squad and subscribe. And while you're at it, make sure to hit that like button. Okay, here we go. I open the sides of the box slowly on purpose, looking at the camera as I do so. All right, Max, bring the camera with me. I'm going in, and I want all the Lizziacs out there to come with me. Let's see this together. Okay, what is in the box? I pull the flaps open, and Max is leaning over my shoulder with the camera. My heart is racing. I can't believe how scared I am just to see what's in this crazy box. I can't even breathe.
Is that another box?
Max says from behind me. It's another box. I reach in and grab the box that's inside the main box, and I lift it out for everyone to see. Then I put it beside the main box on the table. Let's see if there's anything else inside the big box before we open the smaller one. Max shows the inside of the box for the viewers. It's empty. If there's anything that made those wet marks, it must be in that smaller box. Should we dive in? Comment below and tell us what you think. I'm really nervous, everyone. This is super sketch. Why was there a box in the box? I mean, that's pretty sus.
Let's check out some of the comments.
Max announces.
Cleo says she still thinks it's a baby. We've got a slew of body part suggestions. Marco 666 says it's a human heart. Someone said fingers. We've got a few people that think it might be an animal. I just saw like 3 comments for dead cat.
I'm shaking my head and making my best gross face for the viewers. Ew, I hope not. Anyone who follows my Insta knows that I'm a cat person. I love my Toby, and I would be super sad if the dark web did that to us today. But I guess we're gonna find out, right? Y'all ready for me to open up this other box? Ugh, guys, I'm like super nervous. I don't know why. I do crazy and scary things all the time. I'm never nervous like this. It's insane. Please, don't let it be someone's cute, sweet Toby. I will literally cry on a live. Y'all would see Lizzie crying in Cat Lover.
What if it actually is Toby?
Max reads.
Loverboy42001, that would be truly horrifying. That wouldn't only break Lizzie's heart, but it would definitely cement the legacy of the dark web. Can you imagine? We order something blindly from a stranger and get Lizzie's own cat in a box.
All right, can we please stop? This is not even funny. I'm getting legit upset, like literally. I don't even want to think about something happening to Toby. I don't find that funny at all. And now I'm picturing little Mr. Love Whiskers in my mind, chasing his favorite toy like it's an actual mouse. Dear God, or whoever, please don't let there be an animal in that box. All right, Lizziax, let's just do this. I use the knife to cut open the next box. My breath catches in my throat. I can hear my heartbeat. This is definitely going to be my best live ever. I pop the tabs and pull the box open. When I look in, I actually grunt my frustration. Unbelievable, what the hell?
Is that another box?
Max asks. Yes, you're the one that got this. I mean, my fans have been waiting. Is this a prank? Because if this is a prank, we're gonna lose subscribers over it, and I'm gonna be seriously pissed, Max. This is not a good time for a prank or a good way to prank me, because you're not just pranking me, you're pranking every Lizziac that's been waiting for the unboxing of the dark web blind box, man. Max has been backpedaling through my whole monologue and stuttering. Now he says,
It wasn't me. I didn't do anything but get you what you asked me to get, Lizzie. I swear it. I didn't prank you. I have no idea what's in this box. I promise.
I sigh. All right, everyone. I'm leaving it to you. Comment below and tell me if you think Max is telling the truth or not. What do you think? Max looks really nervous. I don't know if that's a sign of his guilt or a sign of his truthfulness. I just know there better eventually be something in this box. Now I'm nervous for a completely different reason. This could be a huge disaster. I will fall from grace so fast it isn't even funny. They'll dub me a fraud.
They believe me,
Max says.
Look.
I check the feed and sigh again. All right, Lizziax, it seems like you all believe Max is telling the truth. I think it might just be because he's cute, but either way, you speak, I listen. It's gotten us this far, right? So, let's keep going. On to the next box. You ready, Max?
Ready.
He still sounds scared. Maybe he's afraid there won't be anything in the next box, too. If he's afraid, then he probably doesn't know the answer. Maybe he really is telling the truth. I take my time cutting open the next box, trying to rebuild the suspense. When I open it and find another box, I give up. I pull it out and set it aside, then stare at the camera with my hands on my hips. Well, I guess the wet marks were just something on the outside of the box. Something that happened during shipping from wherever the heck this box came from. Let me know below if you think it's all empty or if there will eventually be something in one of these boxes. It's definitely past the point of being a baby. So, the last box was far too small for a kid. Maybe a cat still, but I hope not. I don't wait for their response anymore. I just go and cut the next box open. Of course, it's another box. I just cut that one open right away, and there's another box. I cut that one open, and there's nothing. That's it. It's empty. No more boxes, no content, nothing. I'm screwed. You gotta be kidding me. I ordered a blind box from the dark web, and I get a box full of boxes, like one of those Russian dolls full of smaller and smaller dolls. I expected more from you, dark web. To say I'm disappointed is an understatement. For everyone that tuned in tonight to see this unboxing, I give you my most sincere apologies. This sucks. I look at the screen and the comments are saying things like, "Who's that?" It's spooky and concerns me, so I turn around quickly to see for myself. "Macy? What are you doing here? We're live right now. You're on camera." I try to shoot Max a look to tell him to get his girlfriend out of here before an already bad night turns worse, but he says,
"Macy, what's in your hand? What are you doing with that?"
That's when I notice the cleaver. Before I can react, it comes down and lops my hand off at the wrist. It's surreal at first. It's hard to believe that my best friend's girlfriend just chopped off my hand, but there it is, on the table beside me. There's a lot of blood. I'm staring at it in shock as it just keeps pouring from where my hand used to be.
"What the hell, Macy? Why?"
Max is screaming. I know I should be screaming, but I just keep staring at my bleeding wrist.
"Shut up. Just keep filming. And my name isn't really Maisie."
"What? What does that even mean? We've been going out for 6 months. I don't understand. Is this because of me? I didn't cheat on you."
Maisie laughs. I'm really starting to feel faint now. I'm wobbling and probably going to fall soon.
"Don't flatter yourself, Maxie,"
Macy, or whoever she is, says.
"I don't care about you. This is business, and that's all."
"Business? What kind of business? What does that even mean?" I'm on my knees now, struggling to stay awake and hold tightly to my wrist. Macy faces the camera and looks right into it. She picks up my hand and puts it in one of the boxes on the table.
"For everyone that ordered pieces of the famous influencer, Lizzie Gordon, they will be on their way to you shortly. As you can see, I have the boxes open and ready, and I'll be filling them as we speak."
"What the hell are you talking about, Macy?"
Max is screaming. It sounds like he's crying.
"You cut her damn hand off! Are you insane? We need to call an ambulance!"
Macy turns back to me and says,
"Keep filming."
"Why? Why would you want me to film this?"
"People paid a lot of money on the dark web for parts of this girl, and they need to see that it's the genuine article. The police will come, so don't worry. I'll be gone when they do. So I need to work fast. I don't want my seller rating to go down."
What's in the box?" I question. I mumble, half conscious. "There is nothing in the box because I'm what's in the box? How could this really be happening?" Macy doesn't answer me. She just laughs, and then she hacks off my foot, and I finally find my scream. Macy is taking me apart, piece by piece, on my own live, with all my fans and friends watching. At least I know it will go viral and my death will be famous. I look at the computer screen as I fall on my belly in a pool of my own blood. It's so sticky. I can see the numbers already climbing. My viewers are in the millions. I feel offended by the amount of likes it's getting, though. What kind of sick people would like this? The kind that follow a horror influencer and want to see frightening, horrible things every day, I guess. Damn. At least I can see the comments and people seem to be upset and yelling. So many want to know if it's real. I wish it wasn't. Infamy or not, I'd rather live. I guess my inability to vibe with Macy went deeper than her being Max's girlfriend. I didn't see the signs. Would I have seen them if I hadn't been banging Max? I don't know. Does it really even matter now? She just put my foot in a box to send to someone. I can't help but wonder what they plan to do with it. I mean, the internet is full of foot weirdos. Max is one of them, but I'm pretty sure he didn't order it, or he wouldn't be screaming so much. I can't see the screen anymore because Macy has grabbed my hair and yanked my head up awkwardly. I can hear Max pleading. He's begging for my life, asking her to stop.
"No stopping now,"
she says.
"I spent months working for this. Working you. Making all the arrangements and bids. When you asked for the blind box, you really were blind, Maxie. You had no idea it was me you were communicating with. I gave you what you wanted, though, didn't I? You got boxes of prizes for the dark web, and a viral video with tons of new subscribers. Now you just need another girlfriend and another pretty bestie to screw, and you're all set.
Max doesn't answer. He probably ran out of things to say.
Please,
I say weakly.
Relax, Lizzie,
Macy says to me.
The pain will be over soon. Your head is next. I'll take the other parts and box them for shipment after you're gone.
Please.
I try again, but I know it's no use. How much did they pay her? How much did my parts cost? Are different pieces worth more or less than others?
Getting your heart will be messy, but I got paid the most for that,
Macy tells me, answering my silent question. Then she tugs my hair harder, and I feel a blinding, searing pain in my neck. But it doesn't last long. In a moment, I don't feel anything at all. I see the box as I'm heading towards it. Then I stop seeing anything.
Please remember to like and subscribe,
Macy says, as the world goes dark.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I hope you enjoyed The Box, as written by Kisto Healy and performed by Melissa Medina, Danielle Hewitt, and Eric Peabody. Our second tale of the evening is written by Scott Savino and performed by Nick Goroff and Jeff Sturdivan. In it, we return to Echo Bay, where an Elderite Polytechnical University student is pledging to join an ancient fraternal order, and his sponsor sends him a list of rules as well as a document scanned from a textbook telling the strange story of how a 9th century Viking transformed. So, without further ado, I present to you The Lodge of the Ancient Order of Kozeron.
Hello again, Eric. I'm reaching out to you regarding your intent to pledge to the Lodge of the Ancient Order of Kozeron. As you are already aware, this fraternal brotherhood is unlike the fraternities at other universities. In fact, it has nothing to do with so-called Greek life at all. Membership with our lodge will not only help you as you attend Eldertide Polytechnic University here in Echo Bay, but you will find that the Brotherhood of the Lodge will help you in life after your matriculation has concluded. Many Lodge members find successful careers in law enforcement, politics, and several are CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. Before we invite you to participate in the pledging ceremony, we do want to ensure that you know and understand a few things about the Lodge. 1. Everything you learn about the Lodge as a pledgeling or full member is strictly confidential. You will be required to sign a non-disclosure agreement in order to proceed further. Failure to uphold your end of this agreement has dire consequences, which will be discussed further with you should you desire to continue pledging. 2. Mastery of a martial art is compulsory. The Lodge will not dictate which form or forms of martial arts to pursue, and there is no time constraint or expectation for you to reach a level of mastery quickly. As far as the Lodge is concerned, you may pursue mastery for the rest of your life, but your attempts must be earnest. This will be verified yearly for the rest of your life. Again, failure to uphold your end of this will be met with dire consequences. Please consider this before continuing. 3. The scarification rite is mandatory. It hurts. A lot. You will bear the mark of the brand below your left ankle for the rest of your life. You will have trouble walking as the scar left by the brand heals. This rite is another of our many secrets, and my brother and I recommend wearing a bandage and using crutches as the scar heals. Claiming to have a sprained ankle is the easiest way to explain away your trouble walking for several weeks, and you are welcome to come water skiing with us on the day of the ceremony, should you choose to use this excuse. Spraining your ankle doing an activity will give your story the appropriate alibi. You don't have to come with us, but we like you, so we wanted to invite you. 4. We use a coded language when speaking about the lodge in public. Don't worry, this is fairly simple to master, and you will learn it quickly. 5. Membership is for life. Yes, life. You cannot leave. Ever. Please consider this carefully before continuing forward. Attempting to leave, again, will be met with dire consequences. There are a number of other considerations you will need to consider as you pledge, but we find these to be the most important. In addition, please review the attached file and memorize the contents to the best of your ability. It is an account of Khazaron's rise in early history. This document was generously scanned page by page by Eldertide Polytechnic University's head librarian, Darlene Fisher, from a 1934 university textbook, which is kept in her private and restricted collection. This textbook, of which only one remains, contains an entire chapter of what is considered by experts to be the most accurate, definitive account of Khazaron's history. It is a great privilege to have this information shared with you, so please recognize that and act accordingly. Commit as much of it as you can to memory, as the Grand Navigator will frequently quiz you about its contents prior to accepting your application for lodge membership. Finally, if you have any questions, please reach out to me or my brother, Dean. As your sponsors, we will be happy to answer any and all questions. If you fail, it reflects poorly on us. So do not embarrass us, Eric. Sincerely, Devin James.
The Viking ship known as Glorkaffi disappeared on its journey homeward to the shores of Norway as it traversed the freezing waters of the North Sea with its sister ships, the Skelmir Hilif and Sharta Havasi. It would be the final voyage of all three ships led by the famous Viking raider Kortan Sigurd, and myriad pieces of the Skelmir Hilif, Sharta Havasi, was said to have washed ashore near Lindisfarne, England, the town that they set out from after a great storm ravished and destroyed them. The winds and waves that night were responsible for drowning their respective crews and reducing both ships to kindling. Although historical documents from the corresponding time period and region of Britain assume the same fate befell the Glorkaffi, something very different happened to Kortan Sigurd and the men on that ship. The raid was said to have been swift and brutal. The Viking warriors led by Sigurd, in documents written by Brother Godric Edwin, an Anglo-Saxon monk at the Lindisfarne Priory, are described as a band of savage heathen men whom hath once more come ashore, bringing ruin to the holy churches and townships that lie within the countryside's embrace. Three ships did arrive at break of day, one bearing the shape of a giant seashell carved upon its prow, another adorned with a heart, and the final with the visage of a dragon, adorned with fierce clawed talons striking fear. The men aboard these vessels slew all who stood against them, robbing their victims of money, treasures, and even their food, ere they set their homes ablaze, reducing them to naught but ashes. Brother Godric Edwin also describes the storm that night. mentioning it the following day in his private diaries. The tempest that did wreak havoc upon the coast yestereve was terrible and treacherous, verily the work of some evil force. The north tower of our holy monastery was smitten by lightning, causing a great fire in its wrathful strike and taking Abbot Edwulf Oswin from us. Between the dire events of the day and the calamities of the night that followed, the happenstances on the 19th day of June in the 824th year of our Lord shall forever be graven upon my memory. The histories inscribed by this monk and others of the Lindisfarne Priory claim that, upon finding pieces of wrecked longships mere days after the raids, the Chlorocarphy was destroyed along with its sister ships the Skelmyrhilich and the Hjarte Hvassi in the storm that ensued after the violent plunder that befell the English coastline. There are, however, conflicting historical documents recorded by the Siqua people, a Native American tribe settled on the coast of New England in North America during the same time period. This unverified history is quite possibly the true fate of Cortan Sigurd and the Chlorocarphy. For in early 1932, during a ground excavation for a local business, a ship of Viking origin, with a dragon's head prow, matching Brother Godric Edwin's description, was unearthed from where it was buried near Vale Reef Beach at the southern boundary of Echo Bay. Experts confirmed that the type of wood used, as well as the building style of the vessel, matches the construction of others built in the time period and location where the Chlorocarphy originated, lending further credence to the idea that the ship was not destroyed, but was instead separated from its sisters during the violent storm, inexplicably finding its way completely undamaged and wholly intact other side of the Atlantic Ocean. According to Siqua historians, the tale that follows originated from stories told by the physical manifestation of an oceanic deity known as Corazon, who shared his history with the tribe when he encountered them sometime in the 9th century. It has been shared in tribal memory for over 1,200 years via word of mouth, art, canoe carvings, and architectural adornments from different time periods in their tribal history, and remains a major part of the Siqua's tribal identity to this day. After successfully raiding Lindisfarne and the surrounding countryside, Cortan Sigurd and his men returned to their ships, securing their plunder and setting sail for home. The trio of longships were particularly quick and were thought to have possibly moved at an average speed of 8 to 12 knots, taking them approximately 3 to 5 days of rowing with breaks and weather factored in to make the approximate 800-kilometer return trip to their village on the coast of Norway. Typically, Viking longships of this time period sailed within view of the coastline and did not sail directly across open seas, causing a journey that would otherwise take approximately 2 days to take nearly twice as long. Sigurd was standing at the helm of the Chlorocarphy, adorned with its intricately carved prow, when the sky suddenly darkened and the wind began to howl like a vengeful spirit. A fierce and unexpected storm descended upon the three ships out of nowhere just hours after they set sail. The seas roared, and monstrous waves reached their great hands towards the sky, threatening to capsize the raiding party's ships with every gust. The men of the Chlorocarphy watched in horror as a maelstrom opened beneath the Hjarte Hvassi and Skelmyrhilich, spinning them around and around one another in endless circles as their crews attempted to frivolously row their vessels to safety. The men watched as the efforts of those in the longships were unsuccessful, and the whirlpool snapped the oars that competed against its current one by one, eventually swallowing both ships whole, and beginning to pull at the lone Viking longship that remained. As the Chlorocarfi spun in the very same current that its sisters perished within, a great wave submerged the deck, taking three of the crew overboard and into the watery depths. The remaining men clung to the ship, white-knuckled and fearful, as the maelstrom's grip tightened and their fate seemed set in stone. When the intense storm finally abated, Corten Sigurd and his men remained aboard the ship adrift in a dense fog, obscuring their vision of everything past 2 or 3 feet in every direction. The mist was so thick that when the men stood at the stern, they were unable to see the bow of the Chlorocarfi at the other end. The sun above them, showing barely through the haze, appeared as an illuminated ghostly disk. And worst still, not a single one of the men could remember how they survived. They could recall the onset of the typhoon, the terrifying whirlpool, and watching their sister ships being crushed as they were sucked down to the bottom. But the memory of how they escaped that fate themselves was a blank void, as if it were wiped from their minds. Among Sigurd's men was one woman who went by the name of Aud Olofsdottir, a fierce shield maiden and soothsayer, Rivulva, as she was known in their native tongue, who claimed to have received a prophetic vision during the storm. Over many years, the men learned to listen to her and listen closely when she shared her visions with them, as she was a skilled storyteller, and her prophecies became truths quite often. She spoke of a great kraken, a monstrous, spear-headed creature with dozens of great reaching tentacles emerging from the depths at the very center of the maelstrom and pulling at the Chlorocarfi into the spinning waters. According to her vision, as it began to capsize, instead of allowing the longship to overturn, the great beast held it upright and level for a moment. It raced it up and above the waves just for a moment, before it pulled the ship into the maelstrom's center and underwater entirely. Instead of becoming submerged beneath the viciously undulating surface, the crew found themselves traveling through a mystical tunnel beneath the waves, a water passage that encircled the ship above and below and seemed to stretch endlessly before and behind them. She claimed that this underpass beneath the surface of the water was a place of unremembering, where the passage of time and the movement of the ship became entirely meaningless. The span between the storm and waking in the fog, which seemed to the men to be mere moments, was actually, she claimed, to be over 3 weeks. Some of the men who heard her telling of this vision claimed that it simply could not be so, and at this, she urged them to check their stores of food and fresh water.
"You will find them nearly depleted," she said. "I tell you, it has been nigh on a month since we sailed through this otherworldly realm as guided by some unforeseen force, and in that time we have consumed nearly all of our provisions."
Their stores of food, which were mostly stolen during the raid, should have lasted them for nearly 20 days, and what remained of their supply of fresh water was barely enough for 4. Although the barrels should have been nearly full for their journey, was only meant to last a week or two and no longer. At this revelation, the men were dismayed and disoriented, and looked to Cortan for leadership and guidance. Knowing no other means of escape from their plight, he ordered them back into the hull and to begin rowing in a direction that, unsure of their location and lacking means of navigation through the fog, he chose arbitrarily, desperately hoping it would lead them safely to land and salvation. For 5 days they rowed, and the thick blankets of mist hanging in the air never lifted. Morale plummeted as hunger and thirst gnawed at their resolve to continue onward, and some of the men began to believe and share in whispers that they surely must be dead. Their reasoning was that the maelstrom actually crushed their longship, like it had done to its sisters, and while the other crews made it to Valhalla, they somehow found themselves lost along the way. On the sixth night, shortly after the first of their numbers was found dead of malnutrition and dehydration in his bunk below decks, the waters around the Chlorocarfi were discovered to be glowing with a neon-green phosphorescence and illuminating the fog with an eerie light. Both things were interpreted by most of those on board the ship as a malevolent sign. No one knew why he chose that night, when the water shimmered with an eerie glow. But even among the most rational of the crew could be tempted to drink the seawater at this point, driven by their relentless thirst.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Perhaps this man, unlike the others, saw the neon waters as a divine omen. The first to drink was Vontel Eriksson, who lowered a bucket into the glowing sea and raised it to his lips, swallowing nearly half without even attempting to skim the luminescent algae from the surface. In the waters around Echo Bay, the phosphorescent green glow is a familiar sight, and is caused by Psychotrix algae. This algae, more abundant before the bay was settled, is still illegally harvested, dried, and processed for its consumption to this day. Known for its vivid glow and psychedelic properties, Psychotrix algae poses a significant risk if not properly prepared. Studies reveal that improper processing can lead to severe irrationality and bouts of inexplicable violence, especially in those with weak or compromised constitutions. Thus, when the six starving and thirsty crew members were convinced by Vontel to drink the water with him, each of them fell into a state of frenzied madness. These seven men became the crew's undoing. That night, driven by insatiable hunger and the effects of Psychotrix, determined Odd Olafsdottir to be the weakest of the crew. They stabbed her to death and cut away strips of her stomach, which they began to eat raw. It wasn't until they began to consume her uterus, intestines, and liver that they were witnessed by another crewman who happened upon them in the midst of their gruesome act. Being greatly outnumbered by the madmen, he retreated above deck to alert Kort and Sigurd about what he'd seen happening below. Most of the men gathered on the deck, drawn by the eerie glow of the eldritch waters. Kortan, rallying his remaining best fighters, descended below deck to confront the madmen turned cannibals. A brutal battle ensued, with the intoxicated men holding the advantage. The uncured algae granted them unnatural strength and cunning. In a short time, they overpowered Sigurd and his fighters, capturing Sigurd and binding him tightly to a beam. As the remaining crew discovered the mutiny, they attempted to reclaim their ship, descending below deck to attempt to overthrow the mutineers and free their leader. However, the madmen's enhanced abilities led to a bloody slaughter. One by one, Sigurd's men fell until only Kortan remained, shouting at the mutineers and demanding to be released. The madmen taunted him for hours, their eyes gleaming wild the entire time. Before the night was through, they mutilated their captain, severing his arms at the elbows and cutting off his legs, tossing them into the glowing sea. Kortan was strong, and his strength and desire to live never faltered, even at the end when they threw him, still alive, into the freezing neon waters as well. This marks a pivotal moment in Sikwa tribal history, where legend and myth become one. For Kortan Sigurd did not perish.
Indeed. What transpired next endowed him with everlasting life. Zygon, eternal and undying, in this time period was already inhabiting the waters of Echo Bay, and was already living there, to his dream state for eons. His followers on land were already brewing cetacean essence, and undergoing the telltale transformations and adaptations necessary to live with him beneath the waves for several hundred years. At this time, the Shining City in the fabled Coral Caves was considerably smaller than its present size. By 824 AD, death departures were occurring in small, unrecorded numbers within the Sequa tribe. With the Zygonian fish people beneath the black waves of Echo Bay numbering between 750 and 900 souls. It is crucial to note that the true scope and size of the Shining City has never been accurately counted or estimated with any degree of success. By the time of this publication in 1934, it is thought that over 5,000 souls reside in the Shining City. The Zygonian fish people do not permit outsiders, particularly census takers, to enter their great secret city, and likely never will, rendering these numbers unverifiable. Experts concur that the population of the Coral Cave's Shining City is at least double that of Echo Bay. However, many argue that this undersea population is easily three times larger than the land-based population. For more information on Zygon, Zygonian enclave, Zygonian fish people, cetacean essence, or depth departure, refer to Chapter 12, The Lore and History of Zygon, beginning on page 137. Having been noticed by Zygonian scouts 2 days prior, the Chlorocarfi was already being watched closely by the residents of the Shining City. And as Corton Sigurd's body sank beneath the waters, it was collected by 3 Zygonian oracles. Moving hastily and employing the use of their dark magic, the priestesses dismembered a giant lobster, attaching its limbs, tail, and legs to Corton Sigurd's torso, thus saving his life. When Corton awoke beneath the sea, his eyes slowly adjusted to the dim, otherworldly light filtering through the water. Confusion gripped him as he took in his strange surroundings. An underwater temple filled with bioluminescent sea creatures and phosphorescent algae. Before him stood the 3 oracles, pleasure painted across their scaled faces with their work, and for a short time, he strained to comprehend the alien environment. When they spoke to him, he did not understand their words, and he slowly began to grow agitated. As realization dawned, this confusion and agitation gave way to a burning wrath. The annals of Viking mythology are clear. A slain warrior's rightful place is within the hallowed halls of Valhalla, where he would feast and fight for eternity. Yet, by some cruel twist of fate, Cortan found himself denied this glorious afterlife. His resurrection beneath the waves was not a blessing but a curse, a theft of his warrior's reward. Fueled by this perceived outrage and denial, Cortan's rage intensified. His once noble visage twisted with fury, he turned on the very oracles who saved his life. These mystical seers of the deep, revered for their wisdom and power, unwittingly incurred his vengeance. He saw their actions not as a salvation, but as a condemnation, a denial of his divine right. As their mangled bodies began to turn the waters of their sacred temple red, Cortan breathed heavily of their mystic blood as it commingled with the seawater. In breathing this blood, he was further imbued with the dark magics of the Zygonian priestesses. This act of destruction and desecration within the sacred confines of one of Zygon's temples, nestled in the secretive Shining City, the coral caves did not escape notice. Zygon himself, a nightmarish entity with a slick, reflective black form, both squid-like and humanoid, bearing a colossal obsidian shell upon his back stirred from his eternal slumber. Waking from his dream state, and rising up from the abyss, he ascended through the chasmic cliffs of his sleeping crevasse, swimming directly to the temple where the massacre transpired. Within moments, his formidable tentacles rent the walls of the sacred sanctuary to rubble, and upon discovering Khortan still within, a titanic clash between the two ensued. Zygon found himself facing an evenly matched adversary in the transformed Viking. The battle raged with ferocity, hand to tentacle, for nearly an hour. When Zygon's powerful whip-like appendages succeeded in tearing the newly attached claws from Khortan's arms, it seemed as though victory was within his grasp. Yet in a twist neither combatant anticipated, something extraordinary occurred. Lobsters possess the remarkable ability to regenerate their claws through a process of molting their exoskeletons. This regeneration process begins immediately upon the loss of a limb, with a bud forming at the site of the wound. In an ordinary lobster, it may take several molts to fully restore a missing claw or limb, and depending on the age of the lobster, this may be a process that takes anywhere from a year to 5 years total. For this remarkable ability to allow for eventual regrowth. However, imbued with the supernatural blood of the oracles, Khortan's regeneration defied the natural order. To the astonishment of both Zygon and Khortan, his claws began to regenerate instantaneously. The exoskeleton formed and shed multiple times within mere seconds. In less than a minute, the missing claws were fully regrown from where Zygon severed them. Defeated and bewildered, Zygon retreated into the spiraling abyss of his onyx shell. Once fully ensconced, the ominous sound of stone grinding against stone echoed through the depths as he plopped off the shell's opening and sank slowly to the ocean floor, leaving behind a trail of bioluminescent mucus in his wake. Khortan continued his assault on the impenetrable shell where it lay at rest on the ocean floor for quite some time, his relentless blows failing to make a dent in the unnatural and unholy barrier that shielded the ancient god. At last, conceding the futility of his efforts, Khortan abandoned the fight. He swam back to the surface, resolute in his determination to attend to other unfinished business that awaited him above the waves. It did not take long for Khortan to locate the Chlorocathy, despite the dense fog and shrouding its surface. Finding it was easy for him amidst the eerie, glowing waters. His newly transformed limbs, both dexterous and sure-footed, allowed him to scale the side of the longship with ease. And with a mighty heave, he hoisted himself aboard the deck, where the mutineers were still celebrating their ill-gotten victory, their minds still twisted by the hallucinogenic effects of the psychotrix algae. Khortan cleared his throat, a sound that sliced through their carousing and caused the startled men to turn and face him in horror. The only remaining vestiges of his humanity were the intricate patterns of tattoos on his chest, his furious bearded face, and his long, elaborately braided hair. With his newfound power, Khortan exacted a brutal revenge on the mutineers, slaughtering them for their betrayal and casting their severed limbs into the sea. Having satisfied his vengeance, Khortan left the ship and ventured into the vast ocean depths. For many months he explored the underwater realms, encountering many creatures native only to Echo Bay. Creatures both wondrous and terrifying.
His journey was marked by continuous clashes with the Zygonian fish people who still believes they might find a way to best him in battle and earn the glory and recognition of Zygon. Every fish person who attempted to fight him in the sand and the depths of the open waters was repaid for their efforts with death. Kozaron and the Sequa tribe. The Sequa tribe had been living along the coast of Echo Bay for generations prior to 825 AD, their existence deeply intertwined with the rhythms of the tides and the whispers of the ocean. They held a profound belief in the spirits dwelling within the watery depths, chief among them, Zygon himself. Their ritual and traditions were inextricably linked with the natural world of the sea, as they considered themselves the guardians of its enigmatic mysteries. According to Sequa tribal historians, Kortar emerged from the waves in Twilight Cove, located on the north side of their village one sunny afternoon. He was first spotted by a pair of tribesmen who were fishing on the shore. Horrified and awestruck by his appearance, they abandoned their belongings, including a basket containing their substantial catch, and ran back to the village to alert the tribe. Kortan observed these men, picked up their abandoned basket in his claws, and followed them with a curious demeanor. The elders, trusting their word, sounded the alarm by blowing three times into a conch shell, prompting the entire tribe, except for one, to flee the small village. The elderly and infirm hid among the high sand dune grasses, while the young and able-bodied quietly and quickly ascended the hidden paths within the Twilight Pass cliffs. Everyone halted where they stood when Kortan arrived, with many crouching in the seagrass along the rocky path, and others watching from the cliffs with shocked amazement. Kortan briefly surveyed the village before sighing and leaving the basket of fish at what he supposed was the village center. Observing this, the one man who had stayed behind decided to emerge from his hiding place. Talinuk, a trusted member of the tribal shaman, approached Kortan with curious reverence, sensing an immense power radiating from him. After several minutes of circling Kortan, who stood unmoving, Talinuk beckoned the villagers, signaling that it was safe to return. No one living on land had ever seen Zygon, so when Talinuk proclaimed that this being was the manifestation of the deity in physical form, the tribe fell to their knees, offering respect and pledging their devotion. Kortan, unable to understand their language, did nothing to correct the misunderstanding and seemed to accept their worship. The tribe celebrated their fortune, believing they were in the presence of a divine entity from the sea. As days turned into weeks, Kortan remained among the Sequa, gradually learning their language and lifestyle. His presence became a central part of their daily lives, integrating himself into their customs and routines. Yet, a schism began to form within the tribe, as not all members were wholly convinced of his divinity. A young warrior named Mako, known for his strength and perceptiveness, started to question Kortan's true nature. Over time, Mako's suspicions grew, and he became convinced that this creature was not Zygon. He began to quietly whisper to others, suggesting that Kortan was a mere usurper seeking to disrupt their sacred traditions. His skepticism resonated with many in the tribe, finding a receptive audience among the doubtful. The division reached a breaking point when Kortan, struggling with his newfound language, mispronounced words that evoked laughter from a crowd of onlookers. Losing his temper, Kortan destroyed one of the tribe's sacred totems, throwing it into a bonfire before retreating hastily back to the sea. He was not seen nor heard from for many days.
This act of desecration was too much for Mirko and his followers. They accused Talanuk and the Shamanic Council of leading the tribe astray, sparking a fierce debate among the Sikpa people. In a matter of days, the once unified tribe stood on the brink of civil war. Unable to reconcile their differences, the tribe split into two factions. Mirko and his followers, steadfast in their belief that Khortan was not Zygon, chased Talanuk and his supporters out of Twilight Cove. Mirko declared Twilight Cove a sacred site, insisting it should only belong to the true believers in Zygon, as the one true sea god. Talanuk and his followers, still devoted to Khortan, relocated to Vale Reef Beach on the southern end of Echo Bay. When Khortan emerged from the waves once more, the faction remaining in the original village acted as though he were invisible. Using his limited understanding of the Sikwa language, Khortan attempted to apologize, having finally realized that the people worshipping him believed him to be Zygon. Despite his efforts, they ignored him entirely, until one of the elders broke the silence. The elder, using simple words that Khortan mostly understood, explained where those who still loved and followed him had relocated. Over the following weeks, Khortan learned much more of the language from his devoted followers. He gradually dispelled their misconception, explaining that he was not Zygon. As his grasp of the language improved further, he recounted to the elders of the exiled faction how he had defeated Zygon in hand-to-hand combat months earlier. He described how the deity had retreated into his shell to escape him. In recognition of his deeds and power, Talanuk bestowed upon him the name Kozawa, solidifying his new identity among the Sikwa. The two factions of the Sikwa tribe continued their fierce struggle for many months, but the relentless conflict began to take a heavy toll on both sides. Leaders from each faction started to recognize the futility of their strife, and in a rare moment of unity, Talanuk and Mirko agreed to meet under a banner of truce. They convened at the rocky outcrop known as Spirit's Reach, a neutral ground sacred to both factions. There they discussed peace and the pressing need to preserve their people and traditions. After several days of intense negotiation, a tentative peace was established. Both factions agreed to respect each other's territories and cease hostilities. The Khazarians would continue to inhabit Vale Reef Beach, while the Zygonians would remain at Twilight Cove. They decided to share the waters and resources of Echo Bay, cooperating only when absolutely necessary to avoid further bloodshed. The fragile peace was maintained through a grudging commerce. The Khazarian faction, with their access to the groves near Vale Reef Beach, and the Khazarians' knowledge of shipbuilding, excelled in crafting canoes. They traded these canoes to the Zygonians in exchange for the right to fish the abundant waters of Twilight Cove. Even the Sikwa, who had splintered from the faction that remained at Twilight Cove, recognized that these waters were the richest fishing grounds in Echo Bay. So they remain, to this day, a testament to the continued devotion and sacrifices of the Zygonian enclave. This arrangement, though fraught with tension, allowed both factions to thrive. The Khazarians used their shipbuilding skills to explore new waters and expand their trade, while the Zygonians, with their deep connection to Zygon, continued their sacred rituals and maintained the fertility of their fishing grounds. The peace forged at Spirit's Reach endured, a delicate balance of mutual respect and necessity, shaping the destiny of the Sikwa people for generations to come.
I hope you enjoyed The Lodge of the Ancient Order of Khosaran, as written by Scott Savino and performed by Nick Goroff and Jeff Sturtevant. On to the show. Longtime resident, Otis Gyrie, that would be me. Well, I have my very own show here on our network, Scary Stories Told in the Dark, which you can hear every Sunday night. That would be tonight. We also have Eric Peabody's Horror Hill, a podcast dedicated to some of our deeper and darker tales. We hope you check him out, too. And Drew Blood's Dark Tales airs Friday, featuring some Southern down-home horror. And don't forget to check out The Fear from the Heartland Archives, featuring more than 120 episodes. Well, friends, our weekly descent into the depths has just about come to a close. But before we go, I would like to take a moment to thank you for joining us tonight and remind you to take a moment to stop by our iTunes page and leave Chilling Tales for Dark Nights a 5-star review and a kind word, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram if you haven't already. And, of course, subscribe to us on YouTube, where you can find an archive of our work going back to 2012. And consider signing up as a patron at our website, ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com, to show your support and get all of our content ad-free. I'm your host for the evening, Otis Gyrie, and as always, it's been a pleasure. Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listeners, sweet dreams.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.